Hello. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity titled Improving Outcomes in Patients with Gout and Chronic Kidney Disease. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, a best-in-class accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians across the globe. Our goal of today's activity is to ultimately help you improve the lives of your patients with chronic kidney disease and gout. I'm Dr. Alan Gabowski, Professor of Medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, an attending rheumatologist at Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. I'm looking forward to our discussion today, which will focus on improving outcomes in patients with chronic kidney disease and gout. There's no question that gout has a significant impact on patient health as well as their quality of life. As clinicians, we must be able to communicate with patients about their condition and, more important, engage them in their care. This involves listening to our patients and understanding their concerns. In addition, we must be able to achieve optimal clinical outcomes, keeping in mind the cost of treatment. With me today to discuss these topics are our expert, Dr. Robin Doerr and Ms. Eva Handy. Ms. Eva Hardy, I'm sorry. My apologies, Eva. Dr. Doerr is clinical professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA in Los Angeles. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you very much.
And Ms. Hardy is a nurse practitioner in the Department of General Orthopedic Surgery at Presbyterian Rust Medical Center in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Welcome, Eva.
Thank you.
Today's activity also includes a unique perspective. We have put the voice of the patient, literally and figuratively, in the center of this program. In the initial step of our development process, I worked with the people at CME Outfitters to design a survey that was sent to key thought leaders. But these thought leaders were not academicians, researchers, or practicing clinicians. Instead, our thought leaders were patients with gout, patients who are extremely active in social media and online gout communities. Their responses represent the voices of more than 8 million people living with gout in the United States. We asked these leaders to share their thoughts with us on the very topics that we will be discussing today. And throughout this program, you will see and hear what they have to say and how we have integrated their feedback into our educational program today. So let's get started. We have three learning objectives for today's activity. The first learning objective is to execute strategies to enhance an understanding of the association between hyperuricemia, gout, and chronic kidney disease. Second, we will engage patients with gout and chronic kidney disease in discussion of gout education and medication adherence. And finally, we will learn how to implement strategies to help us achieve optimal clinical and economic outcomes in patients with hyperuricemia or gout and chronic kidney disease. So Robin, let me start with you. Can you give us a brief overview of gout?
Sure, Alan. Gout is very, very common in the United States, about 4% of the adult U.S. population, which is about 8.3 million Americans have gout. And it's associated with obesity, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, chronic kidney disease, and the diet and lifestyle that we see in most Americans. And there are several medications that also contribute: low-dose aspirin, niacin, thiazide diuretics, and loop diuretics.
Thanks, Robin. Let me engage our audience with a polling question. You'll see the poll on your screen. The question is, how frequently do you discuss with your patients the link between gout and chronic kidney disease? A, at every visit, B, sometimes, C, never. Please take a minute to respond now. We'll share your answers later in our discussion. So we asked our patient leaders if they felt their primary care providers talked with them about the link between gout and chronic kidney disease. And here you will see a number of important points that was brought out in the context of this conversation. Basically, the patients were given information by their patients and other practitioners about their disease, some of which was helpful, but some of which was probably less than informative. One patient was told that they never ever discussed the link between gout and chronic disease, kidney disease, with their physician, and in fact was entirely unaware that there was a link between the two. So in talking with our patients about this link between kidney function and gout, it's very clear that there's increasing room for improvement in our communication skills as well as the information that we're providing. Eva, are these comments reflective at all of what you see in your practice?
I think they are. I think most of the patients that I run across with gout in the orthopedic clinic give me the sense that they think their gout is more of a nuisance rather than the potentially devastating disease that it can be to joints and other organs. And so I think a lot of times in their mind, if they're not having a flare, it's not a problem.
Robin, how about you? Do you see similar themes in your patients with gout?
Oh, exactly. They think of it as an acute disease and have not been educated about the long-term consequences of having hyperuricemia.
Yeah, pretty much the same for me. I think despite some of our efforts to educate our patients, often in the acute painful episode, they really don't hear what's being said to them, even when we do say it, which may not be as often as we like. So with that in mind, let's see how our audience responded to our poll in question, which was how frequently do you discuss with your patients the link between gout and chronic kidney disease? And the answers were at every visit 8%, sometimes 44%, and not surprisingly, never 48%. I think we're beginning to see a theme here, and we need to make sure that we remind our colleagues and clinicians to discuss this with our patients and stress with them the importance of the team approach to care, which can be so important in affecting a great outcome. So Robin, let's talk a little bit more about this relationship between kidney function and hyperuricemia and gout. Help us understand this just a bit more, Robin, in the context of the overview that we're providing.
Well, I'll certainly try to. We know that there's an abnormal net systemic retention of urate, and up to 60% of patients with gout may have renal impairment. This study is an old study, so looking at BUN, not EGFR. And also renal stones may be found in 20 to 40% of patients with gout, so affecting renal function, but also kidney stones as well.
Robin, can you tell us a little bit more about the role of hyperuricemia in gout, and then we'll go on to crystal formation.
All right. So that hyperuricemia is associated with an accelerated decline in estimated GFR and a higher risk of a chronic kidney disease as the patients have hyperuricemia for a longer period of time. But even before starting urate-lowering therapies, over 50% of the patients with gout had some level of renal impairment, and at autopsy, nearly 100% were found to have renal disease.
Not surprising. Now take us through the what we know about crystal formation in gout and the resulting inflammatory response.
We know that monosodium urate crystals precipitate at a serum level of 6.8 milligrams per DL, but that's at 37 degrees centigrade. So patients, their extremities are colder, so we're more likely to have the crystals precipitate and with trauma. So one of my patients only had gout attacks when he was running through an airport, and that pounding of his foot caused the gout attacks to happen in his toe. So besides the trauma and the low temperature, we also see that that dehydration in the joint can certainly cause that to happen, as well as supersaturated serum uric acid levels all contribute to crystal formation. When we look at this, the response of the crystal to the crystals, what we see is that there is a tremendous inflammatory reaction. And when the crystals deposit in the joints, they are phagocytized by the white blood cells. And also there's a messenger that's sent to cause more white blood cells to migrate to the joints. And then these white blood cells secrete a tremendous number of pro-inflammatory cytokines. So we see lysosomal enzymes, prostaglandins, leukotrienes, interleukins, TNF, C-reactive protein, so a tremendous amount of inflammation that's associated with the occurrence of these crystals in the joints.
So, Robin, we have the crystals in the joints, but how does that translate into the clinical damage that we see in our patients?
Well, related to these crystals and the inflammation, we actually see erosions that occur in the joints, much like we see in our rheumatoid arthritis patients. But also, these crystals can form tophi, and these tophi themselves are associated with pain and disability. And on the x-ray, you can actually see the tremendous deformity and loss of the bone and the joint itself related to that crystal damage. What the patients don't understand is that even when their serum uric acid level is not elevated, that there are still crystals in the joint, not enough to cause an acute attack, but enough to cause ongoing joint damage. And that's what we have to educate the patients, that keeping that serum uric acid level down below 6, even when they're not having an attack, is extremely important to preserve joint function.
Interesting. What else can you tell us about gout and tophi?
Well, certainly those tophi can occur at any place in the body. And I've had a patient who had a tophus in their sacroiliac joint and a tophus in the pancreas. So typically we think of them as occurring in the joint, but certainly the patient can have tophi in their kidneys, and even kidney stones can certainly occur, as we discussed already.
So let's move on to talk about the diagnosis. Robin, tell us about some of the conditions that may be confused with gout in clinical presentation, and a useful differential diagnosis for the people who are watching the broadcast.
So it's important, when a lot of times what I see is that the person that sees a patient in urgent care assumes because it's in their big toe that it has to be gout. But certainly patients can have a turf toe, and they stub their toe, and that can cause what looks like gout. They can have a cellulitis over a toe or an ankle, and that can look like gout. Pseudogout, calcium pyrophosphate crystals, can be deposited in joints and can present just like gout, although not usually in the big toe. And then our patients who have psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis related to the tissue breakdown, they can have gout or just typical psoriatic arthritis.
And of course, we've even seen pseudogout as another example of crystal deposition disease, often confused in this area as well, right?
And no question. The other thing is that patients can have both pseudogout and gout in the same joint, or aseptic arthritis and gout in the same joint. So that's why it's really important to try to make an accurate diagnosis of what's going on, and where, in the ideal situation, aspiration of the fluid to look for crystals or to look for evidence of infection is so important.
And that's the gold standard, of course.
And I do find that generally the presentation for pseudogout does seem to be much less severe than an actual gout flare, in terms of how much swelling they have and the severity of the pain, the inability to weight bear.
Yeah, I think something that we often underappreciate, but that our patients are really focused on because it interferes significantly with their activity of daily living. Robin, take us back to some more things involved in the practical diagnosis beyond aspiration.
So if the patient isn't at risk of developing a septic joint, so they're not on chemotherapy, they're not immunocompromised, then we should be feel comfortable making a presumptive diagnosis of gout. And that's where we're going to look at the different risk factors. Is there a family history of gout? Is a patient taking the medications that could increase their risk of developing hyperuricemia? Do they have those other comorbid conditions, the hypertension, the chronic kidney disease, the hypertension? And then the physical exam. Do they have tophi? What does their serum uric acid level look like when we draw the laboratory studies? And do they have a red, hot, very tender joint? About 50% of the time, the first gout attack is in the great toe, but after that, it can be in any of the joints.
So are you suggesting that we can make a diagnosis, or even think about a diagnosis, even in the absence of an aspiration?
Yes, I certainly am, because practically how often are we able to do that? We're seeing lots of patients. I teach how to inject and aspirate a joint, but most of the primary care providers aren't comfortable doing that. So then we have to, and especially in a busy practice, have to make that practical diagnosis.
So if this is a disease of uric acid crystallization, what about the serum uric acid level? Can that be used in any way as a diagnostic marker?
It can be helpful, but by itself it doesn't make the diagnosis, because especially during an acute attack, up to 50% of the time, the serum uric acid level is normal. Ideally, what we'd like to do is to treat the acute attack and then see the patient back 2 weeks later to check that serum uric acid level. But my experience has been with these patients, they treat their acute attack, they don't understand the importance of coming back, and so they never come back. So I'll draw that serum uric acid level at the time of the appointment, and if it's elevated, then I can, with those other comorbid conditions, I can presume it's gout. If it's low, then I can't say that it was a gout attack unless they come back and then have evidence of hyperuricemia.
So we're going to shift gears a little bit and move on to a discussion of guidelines for evaluation and management of gout. We're going to focus on the 2012 ACR guidelines for gout because, after all, you and I are rheumatologists, and Eva, you work with rheumatologists. But our audience should know that there are recommendations for the management of gout that came out of the European League Against Rheumatism, EULAR, just last year. And just last week, the American College of Physicians here in the United States put out guidelines for the management of gout as well. Of course, being rheumatologists, we're sympathetic to those. So Eva, get us started with the recommendations for the American College of Rheumatology.
Certainly. So, of course, patient education with an emphasis on diet and lifestyle recommendations is important, but I think especially we should consider trying to eliminate any non-essential prescription medications that can cause hyperuricemia. And in our Western society here in the U.S., because we do have such a high prevalence of hypertension and cardiovascular disease, some of the most common ones might be loop diuretics or antihypertensives. Also, clinically evaluating the gout disease burden. In other words, are there palpable tophi and how many, which joints are involved, and the frequency and severity of acute and chronic symptoms.
And what about things like comorbidities? Can you give us a checklist for those?
Sure. So metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes in particular, hypertension, again, those serum urate elevating medications are important to consider. Does the patient have a history of kidney stones, or are they likely to develop due to other reasons, either medications or comorbidities? Are they likely to develop chronic kidney, glomerular, or interstitial renal diseases?
And last but not least, of course, is lead intoxication for us old moonshiners out there, right? Southern nine gout. Ava, tell us a little bit about diet and lifestyle recommendations that you give to your patients.
Well, the nice thing about the general health and lifestyle recommendations is they're easy to remember. These are the same ones that we're going to give to any patient with any disease. Losing weight, trying to get as close to an optimal BMI as possible. Eating healthy, a balanced diet, trying to be inclusive of a lot of vegetables. Regular exercise, stopping smoking, and trying to stay hydrated, which is important in my area of the country in the Southwest. But really trying to get that recommended daily intake of water.
Right. And when it comes to eating healthy, I'm not particularly good with that. I asked my doctor what diet I should eat, and he said, I don't care what you eat, just eat less of it. So maybe that's important for our patients as well.
So specifically for patients with gout, we want to make sure they understand the importance of avoiding altogether organ meats that are high in purine content, high fructose corn syrup foods and beverages, which will also go a long way to helping to control their potential metabolic syndrome and help them get to that optimal BMI, and then limiting alcohol use, particularly during gout flares, and especially with beer.
In other words, when all else fails, find out what the patient likes to eat and forbid it, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So let's ask our audience another question. How frequently do you provide specific diet recommendations to your patients with gout? Now be candid, A, at every visit, B, sometimes, C, never. And as before, we'll come back to these results in just a few minutes. I'd like to go back to our patients. Here are some quotes from our patients about dietary guidelines and how well we're communicating this to our patients. Obviously, there's a great deal of concern about to what extent we're managing their gout and explaining the impact of diet on outcomes. Patients have reported just about everything in this area. They've indicated that they should eat a high-protein diet, that they should keep away from spicy foods, that they should eat an organic diet, that they should limit their foods, that they should do it on a one-to-one basis. And clearly, there's a lot of information that is being given when it is being given, but maybe not all of it correct. As one of our patients said,
I find that they do not go over diet guidelines. I wish they would. Most of the information that I got was over the internet. And it would be very helpful if my physician did go over dietary options and things to eat and things to avoid.
Over the internet, and everyone knows that everything on the internet is absolutely true, right? So, Eva, we've talked about this quite a bit during our development calls. Do these responses from the patients surprise you at all?
Not really. I think providers are so pushed for time, maybe due to physician shortages or a variety of reasons with insurance plans, that we're trying to address as many possible things as we can in one 15 or 20 minute window. And it's not always easy to go over the wellness guidelines, particularly with disease like gout, where diet is so important, and lifestyle.
Okay, let's talk now about the indications for pharmacologic therapy. Robin, how do we determine which patients should receive pharmacologic therapy, and as we'll talk about in a few minutes, with what?
It's really important that our patients understand that although diet is very important, that for most of the patients, the diet alone is not enough to prevent the chronic complications of gout. So I always talk to the patients about diet, but certainly talk to them about the importance of beginning medication in those that it's indicated. So typically, if they have a TOFUS on either exam or an imaging study, if they have two or more gout attacks a year, if they have CKD2 or worse, which is very common in these patients, or if they have a past history of renal calculi, so of kidney stones.
So I'd like to just go back for a second and give the audience the results of some polling data, which was A, always, 11%, B, sometimes, 52%, and C, never, which was 36%. And I'm wondering if these responses surprise you at all, Robin. This had to do with the extent that we're talking about the dietary indications, dietary modifications with our patients.
It doesn't surprise me at all, but as Eva said, most of my patients actually go online and look at gout diets, and as you said, sometimes they're not that accurate. So I'm always referring patients to the Arthritis Foundation website or the National Kidney Foundation website so they can have something that they can look at, because oftentimes during a visit, either I'm too busy, hopefully that's not the case, or they're so concerned about getting rid of their acute pain, they're not really paying attention to what I'm talking to them about, not only diet, but then the importance of preventing attacks in the future.
Right, right. So critical to get to the patients when they're able to understand you rather than when they're able to focus on the pain. So, Robin, talk a little bit about serum urate targets and selecting the treatment for patients.
So we talked about earlier that the crystals start precipitating at 6.8 milligrams per DL at a normal temperature. But when we're looking at, in general, because of the low temperature or the trauma in the extremities, our goal in most patients should be a serum uric acid level of less than 6. But in those patients who have frequent gout attacks, or in those patients with tophi, our goal then should be actually getting that serum uric acid level less than 5. So, and then we have to keep on monitoring the patients, because even once we get to goal, they might stop their medicines, they might think they're cured, they might start not following the diet that Eva talked about. So it's really important that we continue to monitor them. So initially, the recommendations in the guidelines are to start with a xanthine oxidase inhibitor therapy, and that's either allopurinol or febuxostat. And at that, so they have the acute attack. Hopefully they'll get that treated adequately and then come back 2 weeks later and then get started on either allopurinol or febuxostat. At that time, though, we also have to start them on anti-inflammatory prophylaxis, a medicine to prevent a gout attack from happening as we're lowering that serum uric acid level. So we use allopurinol febuxostat that lowers the serum uric acid level, but then it mobilizes all those crystals that have been depositing in the rest of the body for the last 10 years or so before their first gout attack.
So Robin, I'm going to interrupt you here and throw you a bit of a curveball.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask you a question like the old song, in Limbo song, how low can you go?
I remember that.
Yeah?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so is there a uric acid that might be too low to aim for in our patients with gout?
And that's a very good question. It's actually been a question that's been addressed in certainly our rheumatology literature. There was a question that if you get that serum uric acid level down to 2 or 3, is that going to increase a patient's incidence of malignancies? Because the concern was that then with that low serum uric acid level, there wouldn't be enough of the body's ability for tumor surveillance. But recent studies in the oncology literature have shown that that's actually not the case. And so that if we get down to 2 or 3, it's still not problematic. Practically, do I ever get patients down to 2 or 3? Not very often.
Yeah, I don't think any of us actually do, nor do we really aim for it. All right, I've taken you on a brief detour.
That's all right.
Let me let you get back on the gout highway, if you will, and take us through long-term management.
All right. So, that, as I mentioned, we start the allopurinol or the febuxostat. If the patient can't tolerate those, then we'll put them on probenecid, which is a uricosuric drug. But probenecid doesn't work very well in people with chronic kidney disease, which many of these patients have, and also increases the risk of kidney stone. So it's not our first line of therapy. If we look at the next slide, then what we see is in dealing with these patients, what I typically do is see them back every couple weeks until I see that their serum uric acid level is down below 5 or 6, but also to make certain that they don't have side effects from the medicines, because as we know, all medicines have side effects, and the urate-lowering drugs can be associated with increased abnormal liver function tests, abnormal kidney function, even rarely affecting the bone marrow, so we need to monitor for these side effects as well. And the other thing we want to do is keep measuring those tophi. So just like we're measuring the serum uric acid level, we want to make certain that those tophi are getting smaller as well.
And I think I may have actually interrupted you at the wrong point, because we have actually another slide of material I'd like you to discuss
all
for
right.
us as well.
All right. So when should the primary care audience refer people like you and me? So if it's not clear what the cause of the hyperuricemia is, if the patient just isn't responding to therapy, maybe they have very large tophi that really aren't getting smaller, or perhaps the patient has had adverse reactions to the different drugs that the primary care provider has prescribed.
So obviously reducing frequency and severity of flares is important for our patients. What is the evidence for anti-inflammatory prophylaxis in gout?
I was involved in the febuxostat clinical trials, and in those clinical trials, the way the protocol was written was after 2 months to stop the anti-inflammatory prophylaxis, which was either colchicine or naproxen. And what was seen in those trials is after the first 2 months when the anti-inflammatory prophylaxis was discontinued, almost all of the patients had a gout attack. And so this is data, again, that's included in the rheumatology gout guidelines, showing that if the anti-inflammatory prophylaxis is only continued up to 3 months, significant number of the patients had an acute gout attack upon withdrawal of the anti-inflammatory prophylaxis, whereas that was much less, between 3 and 6 months. But then, even longer than 6 months, if the patient has tophi, because those tophi are soft tissue deposits of uric acid that can keep on feeding the system and cause more attacks to occur, so that patient needs to be continued maybe up to a year on anti-inflammatory prophylaxis.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned febuxostat. That's a drug that's really shown itself to be a particularly good addition to our armamentarium in a select class of patients, particularly those that we're talking about
with
today,
with chronic
right?
kidney yeah. disease.
So tell us a little bit more about the relationship between serum uric acid concentrations and gout attacks.
Well, we know that if the serum uric acid level is very high, that patient is certainly more likely to have multiple gout attacks. Then our goal, as we talked about, was to bring it down below 6. And as you can see from the study from Shoji, the lower the serum uric acid level is, the fewer gout attacks that the patient has. And so this is really to your point of how low can we go. And again, this slide just shows us that getting down to the lower you could go, the fewer gout attacks that the patient had.
Right. So, Robin, you've discussed very nicely the acute phase, the intercurrent, intercritical, or in-between phase, the chronic phase. Take us through the goals of treatment across the span from the acute to the maintenance to the chronic phase of gout.
Certainly from the patient's point of view, they don't want any gout attacks. So they want to be treated. We treat them typically with an anti-inflammatory, with colchicine, or a steroid, depending on what their comorbid conditions are. Ideally, we like to treat them, wait for the acute attack of gout to go away, have them come back, and that's when we initiate the urate-lowering therapy with either allopurinol or febuxostat. And then we give them the common anti-inflammatory prophylaxis, and then we see them frequently until they reach that goal of 6. But then we need to continue to see them, again, monitoring to make sure it stays below 6, but also monitoring them for any adverse reactions to the medications.
And so that actually brings up a question that's common in my practice. Oftentimes what I'll see is a patient come in with an acute flare, say knee pain, for instance, which is very swollen. Again, they can't bear weight. They may crutch into the office. And after the initial administration of, or perhaps aspirating that joint, confirming a gout diagnosis through crystal microscopy, and then giving them a corticosteroid injection to the joint, I'll often also put them concurrently on an anti-inflammatory or a low dose of steroid, depending on their background and needs, and instruct them to follow up with their primary care provider. But I'm never 100% certain that that's actually going to happen. And so I guess my question would be, how long between seeing me and treating the acute flare should they wait before they absolutely need to see their primary provider about getting on that ULT?
Certainly the ACR guidelines say ideally that's a couple weeks period of time. But as you stated, unfortunately, frequently that is not the case that happens. And because of that, there's a part of the guidelines that even mention that that even during an acute attack, that you can start them on that urate-lowering therapy. It's not ideal. It might make it so the attack lasts a little bit longer. But knowing the tendency of patients not to come back to be started on urate-lowering therapy, if we know that that's happened before, actually starting the patient at that time on the urate-lowering therapy, along with treating the acute attack, and then making certain that they continue on that anti-inflammatory prophylaxis. But a lot of patients don't like taking one medicine to counteract what they look at as the side effect of another medicine. And right. Frequently, they'll take their urate-lowering therapy, stop their anti-inflammatory prophylaxis, and then have a gout attack, and will never come back because I didn't do a good job of taking care of their gout.
So before we get to urate-lowering therapy as a class of agents, let's talk a little bit, or at least finish our analysis, about chronic gout management, Robin.
So in looking at the chronic gout management, our goal is certainly to prevent the joint damage from happening, to prevent tophi from forming, as well as to try to prevent a further worsening of their chronic kidney disease. And the patients need to be educated, the providers need to be educated that this is our goal. The patients want to not have any more gout attacks, but we want to improve their comorbid conditions, try to maintain their kidney function, and for cosmetic reasons, for a lot of the patients, try to get rid of those tophi.
And Robin, you've already begun your discussion of urate-lowering therapy, but now let's drill down a little bit and tell us what types of therapies are used in the management of gout, the data for these agents, and perhaps what to choose when.
So we've already talked about, as you mentioned, the urate-lowering agents, so allopurinol and febuxostat. Already mentioned one of the uricosuric drugs, which is probenecid. Recently approved lesinurad is supposed to be available in the pharmacies at any time. And then there's a uricolytic drug, which is pegloticase, which is an infusion that's given to the patients who have gout that hasn't responded to these other drugs. So this slide looks at the data with regards to febuxostat versus allopurinol, and with the primary endpoint of looking at the last 3 months of the serum urate levels, how often do you reach that less than 6? This slide shows 3 different doses of febuxostat. The 120 and 240 milligram doses are not available in this country. There is a 40 milligram dose, but that wasn't included in the data from this trial.
So by not available, you mean at 120 and 240 are actually off label.
That's correct.
So it's not that we can't combine, we just don't want to go there at all.
That's right, approved right. in other countries, but not approved right. here in the United States. So what we see is when we're looking at the patients with our goal today, the patients with renal disease, we see that 44% of the patients on the 80 milligram, 45% on the 120, and 69% on the very high dose, which is again not approved here, the 69% with renal impairment, reach that goal of less than 6. When we look at the next slide, this is looking at lesinurad, which is approved and should be in the pharmacies any day. And this is, as we mentioned, a uricosuric drug. But as you can see in the data here, it always needs to be combined with a xanthine oxidase inhibitor. So here we see data looking at allopurinol plus placebo, allopurinol plus lesinurad, 200 milligrams, which is the marketed dose. The 400 milligrams is not approved in this country, looking at allopurinol plus 400 milligrams of lesinurad. And you see the allopurinol, only 28% of the patients reached their goal of less than 6, whereas 54% did on the current recommendation, which is allopurinol plus lesinurad, 200 milligrams, and then 59% with the higher dose of lesinurad. And finally, we'll look at pegloticase. This is, as I mentioned, an intravenous infusion, and this study looked at giving the dose every 2 weeks or giving the dose once a month. And here we see that in the first trial that 47% of the patients with every 2 week infusion reached their goal of less than 6, 20% on monthly. And then in the second trial, 38% on every 2 weeks and 49% on monthly.
So Robin, now that we've talked about the management of gout and the agents available for us, let's get to the focus of our program, which is the management of gout in patients with chronic kidney disease. What are some of the considerations we have to think about in that special population?
It's really important when that we are measuring that serum uric acid level that we're also measuring their kidney function. Because if they do have chronic kidney disease, then we want to start them on half of the 100 milligram allopurinol pill. So that a lot of times I'll see patients immediately start on 300 milligrams. And if that's the case, they're more likely to have a toxic reaction to the allopurinol. They're more likely to see that their renal function declines further. So that we need to be very careful initially if they have CKD to start them out at 50 milligrams. And then they need to be seen every couple weeks, or at least have lab done every couple weeks to gradually increase their dose from 50 to 100, 200, 300, whatever it takes, up to a maximal allowed dose of 900 milligrams in the package insert. But again, most people don't use that dose in order to try to get the uric acid level down below 6.
And in fact, don't we colloquially define treatment-resistant gout or allopurinol-resistant gout as above 300 milligrams?
That's correct, because when you look at primary care providers, what dose do they feel comfortable using? 300 milligrams.
Right.
And how many patients do I have on 500 or 600? One or two. Not very many, because as you mentioned, now we have febuxostat. So instead of the patients have to take a lot of pills, we can look at febuxostat, starting with the 40 milligram dose that wasn't included in that trial that I showed you. And then if after a couple weeks they haven't reached their goal of less than 6, then going up to the 80 milligrams.
Good. So, Ava, discuss with us some of the challenges in managing patients with gout from your perspective.
Well, as we can see from all the information on this slide, patient noncompliance absolutely equals an increase in the number of flares. And so, again, going back to that patient education piece, making sure that they understand that their target should be 6 milligrams per deciliter or less, maybe even 5 in some circumstances. And it's interesting here that it shows that one of the studies showed the median length of continuous urate-lowering therapy was only 3 months. And so, again, driving home the point to them that this is not a disease that's going to go away. It's something that's going to have to be managed over the long term. And that means using the medication over the long term.
Yeah, it can be a chronic problem, particularly when patients don't feel what it was that brought them in the first place. So now I want to ask our audience a related question. How frequently are you able to discuss with patients the importance of maintaining a serum uric acid of lower than 6 milligrams per deciliter? A, at every visit, B, sometimes, C, never, and we'll come back and take a look at your responses in a few minutes. Engaging patients in their care is so important in patients with a chronic disease. We asked our patients if they felt their provider effectively engaged them in their care. And you'll see a number of conclusions here, but I think this is consistent with the theme that we have already established, namely that communication and the time for communication continues to be a significant problem. Let's listen to one of our patients tell us about their perspective on what was actually done and what could be done.
I think that my physician could do a better job of engaging me in my care by explaining and helping me to understand and manage the symptoms of gout. I do a lot of research on the internet, so I feel like I do a good job myself of understanding the disease. I understand gout really well. I just think that sometimes physicians are so rushed, basically give you a prescription and get you out of the office. Hopefully, over time, if they get feedback from patients that they aren't doing a great job of explaining, engaging their patients, maybe they'll do better.
So, Ava, does this surprise you that some of our patients think that we're just giving them prescriptions to get them out of the office?
No, not at all. And again, I think, as we made a point earlier, when patients come in with these really intensely painful gout flares, they may not always be open to hearing a whole litany of patient education either. And so that's why it is extremely important to schedule those follow-up visits so that you have a chance at a calmer time when they feel better and they're in a better frame of mind to go over the dietary recommendations and the treatment goals specifically of getting that uric acid level down to 6. And then also in every single visit, driving home those lifestyle modifications and dietary restrictions.
So share with us from your perspective, if you will, a little bit more about how we can involve the patients more in the management of their condition?
Well, I think right now everybody's concerned with higher health care costs. Even if they have some type of insurance, the copays for visits can be pretty substantial. And so helping them to understand that the number of gout flares and the costs associated with those flares go up proportionally with that uric acid level of over 6 would be a good reminder for them and a good motivator for them to get better control.
Yeah, cost and impact are clearly important to our patients, as we've seen particularly in the gout space with colchicine several years ago. Robin, let me go back to you for a few minutes. Recently we saw a published study looking at the development and validation of a disease activity score for gout. Tell us a little bit about that study and how it may apply to our clinical practices.
Well, we know in rheumatology that it's very that we're used to measuring disease activity in a lot of our underlying conditions. So this was a longitudinal analysis of a multi-cohort study that was conducted to design and validate a composite measure of disease activity called GAS. So this is a three-step approach was used to derive the GAS factor analysis, linear discriminant analysis, and linear regression. Factor analysis identified 5 different factors: patient-reported outcomes, joint exam, gout flares, tophi, and serum uric acid. The discriminant function analysis resulted in a correct classification of 79%, which I think is certainly very good. Linear regression analysis identified first candidate GAS, including 12-month flare count, serum urate levels, visual analog pain scores, visual analog global activity assessment, swollen and tender joint counts, and a cumulative measure of tophi. And the GAS demonstrated good correlation with functional disability and discrimination between patient and physician-reported outcomes of disease. So in rheumatology, we're always looking at how to prevent that disability from occurring, how to get the disease activity better. So this is another tool that we can use in the future to show that we are improving patient outcomes.
It's very important to have objective metrics, and maybe this is the first attempt at something in gout, something that we've been using in our other conditions as well.
I agree.
So let's see now if our clinician responses vary from what our patients told us. We asked you, our audience, how frequently are you able to discuss with patients the importance of maintaining serum uric acid of less than 6 milligrams per deciliter. At every visit, 17% of you said, at sometimes 44%, and never 38%. Robin, what do you think about these responses?
Well, I'm glad that we're having this symposium today so that we can talk about the importance of discussing with the patients getting less than 6, and also, though the patients have an idea of if it gets less than 6, then they should have fewer gout attacks, because that's usually their primary goal.
So, Eva, we've covered diagnosis, we've covered treatment across the phases of the disease, we've covered, we think, how to educate and engage patients in their care. Let's try to apply these concepts to one of your patients. So walk us through this case scenario, Eva.
All right, so this case study is on chronic gouty arthritis in an elderly female. These are a couple of x-rays that I took because she sees me fairly regularly for bilateral knee pain, always worse on the right than the left. And so her history is that she's a 78-year-old female, again with gout, but also with stage 3 chronic kidney disease. She has a 2-year history of this bilateral knee pain. Again, usually the right side is more affected. She describes her pain as severe at times, throbbing, tingling, and especially bad with weight-bearing activities. Unfortunately, she's allergic to ibuprofen, but she was told that she could occasionally use colchicine for flares of gout. She presents to my clinic on a fairly regular basis, at least a couple of times a year, for pain in both of those knees. And over time, she has undergone a trial of Hyalgan GF20 for her right knee pain, but she reported that it really didn't work any better for her than a corticosteroid shot. So she's got a lengthy medical history, but I'll draw your attention in particular to the chronic kidney disease stage 3, because that can make her gout particularly challenging to manage. Also noting the hypertension, the obesity, the coronary artery disease that she has, and how all of those can play together to potentially affect the kidneys. along with the gout.
Very complicated patient. I assume we have some vital signs for her and some labs.
Yes. So her BMI was measured at 42.4. A recent pain score was 6 out of 10. Blood pressure was noted to be elevated despite her antihypertensives at 161 over 73, probably in part due on that particular visit to how much pain she was having from the gout flare. Heart rate and temp were normal. And then on physical exam, again, morbidly obese elderly female, moderately severe discomfort. I did see that she had a mild effusion at the right knee. However, it was not red or warm. But she did have significantly limited range of motion on the right side, about minus 20 degrees of extension and only 45 of flexion with pain. Her range of motion on the left was slightly better, but still limited at 0 to 100 degrees of flexion. She could fully weight bear on the left, but only touch down on the right. And she was noted to have tophi over multiple digits in her hands and feet, as well as at her left elbow. And then, as you could see from the x-rays earlier, she was noted to have severe osteoarthritis in the medial and patellofemoral compartments bilaterally. These are some pertinent labs, and I'll draw special attention to, first of all, the fact that her white count does tend to run low, and she's neutropenic. That's an unknown cause, but that can sometimes make it difficult in a patient like that to know whether this is a gout flare versus a possible early septic joint. In her case, it definitely was gout. Her A1C, though, is pretty well controlled at 5.6, but you can see that her BUN and creatinine were both elevated, and her GFR was decreased. Her uric acid, interestingly, the last time it was measured, I combed back through her chart, that was 2 years ago, and it was 9.3 at that time.
You know, you commented on her hypertension, and there are several explanations for it, but I'm beginning to wonder how much of that might also be due to the fact that she has such a complicated medical history, and is probably on so many different medications, that her adherence to the complicated regimen may not be optimum, which of course is a topic for another discussion.
Yes, so, and I did not list her medications here, but she was on roughly a dozen.
Yeah, probably another two slides worth, would be my guess. So before I talk with our faculty about what they would do with this case, I want to ask you, our audience, how you would manage this case. So there are several polling questions on the screen. What would be your next step in managing this patient? A, discuss diet and lifestyle recommendations only. B, initiate treatment with allopurinol. C, initiate treatment with febuxostat. D, no further treatment is necessary at this time. And as we're waiting for you to answer and to summarize your results, Robin, let me begin with you. What are some of the key points in this case that might guide you in one therapeutic decision direction versus another?
That's a good question, because the case isn't straightforward with regards to an acute gout attack. She does have the severe pain, as Eva mentioned, but there wasn't any redness or warmth in that right knee, but severe pain, so she could only touch down. So I, in fact, would assume, if I didn't have time to stick a needle in that joint and look for crystals, that was actually an acute gout attack that was occurring. And I would start her actually on a medication to treat an acute gout attack. Now, she has CKD, so I'd probably use colchicine in this case. And then I'd have her come back, and because of her CKD, I'd probably choose febuxostat over allopurinol. But if I were to use allopurinol, I'd have to start her at the 50 milligram dose.
Well, one might think that given the multiple medications that this patient is on, this might be a case where febuxostat might even be more appropriate, because you could give fewer pills, and in so doing, reduce the complexity of the regimen and increase the patient's adherence. Eva, your thoughts about this patient?
Well, I did think it was interesting in reviewing some of the literature. Colchicine has quite a few medication interactions, and with her being on colchicine and also being on so many other medicines for the comorbidities, I wondered if it might not have been a better choice to treat her with a low-dose steroid when she has a flare.
Good thought. What about the role of the healthcare team in this case? And what are the kinds of things that the team can do to optimize care of our patient? You know, the whole for patients like this is always greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, and so as I alluded to earlier, I do typically see patients who come in with a flare. This is a patient that's well known to me, but many, many times, or more often than not, it's a middle-aged man. It's his first time to ever have symptoms like this. I will make the diagnosis with a needle aspiration, give him a cortisone injection, get him out of the worst of the pain, and then have him follow up with the primary care provider. And so I do think it's definitely a team approach. It's not a one provider issue. They need a primary care provider that can be easily communicated with, perhaps myself as an orthopedic specialist, and maybe even a rheumatologist, depending on how refractory to care they are.
Maybe even a rheumatologist?
Look, there's 8.3 million American people with gout. There are not that many rheumatologists. So that's the reason we're having this today, is to talk to the primary care providers how to take care of this. And then, as I mentioned earlier, send only the refractory cases to us.
Fair enough. So now let's look at how our audience responded. We asked the question, what would be your next step in managing this patient? A, discuss diet and lifestyle recommendations only, and 21% of our audience opted for that option. B, initiate treatment with allopurinol, 31%. C, initiate treatment with febuxostat, 47%, for some of the reasons that I'm sure we discussed. And D, no further treatment is necessary at this time.
Yay!
No one accepted that, right. So good, we're doing our job. Well, we've covered quite a bit today, and before we conclude, I just want to ask Robin and Eva to summarize some clinical connections or key points that they think we should incorporate into all of our practices to improve the care of our patients with gout. So Robin, let me start with you.
Our main goal today was to talk about the association of gout with chronic kidney disease. So the patients need to be aware of that, the providers need to be aware of that. We also need to understand that with the team approach, we need to make certain that those comorbid conditions are not only identified, but then treated. And to explain to the patient that this is a chronic disease associated with chronic kidney disease, with disability and joint damage, and they need to understand it's not just an acute attack.
Eva, your thoughts?
And not dismissing the importance of those lifestyle modifications. I think sometimes providers might forget the importance of teaching those because we're more concerned with the medication regimens or getting the serum studies done in a timely manner, but helping them to understand that those diets and lifestyle modifications are going to be key in managing this process.
Thank you again for joining us for the presentation portion of our program, and please stay with us for our after-the-show program. I hope that you'll be able to integrate some of the strategies we discussed today to provide the best care for your patients as you recognize the important role of the entire healthcare team in improving outcomes and reducing healthcare costs in our patients with gout and CKD. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We've already received a number of questions, so let's jump right in so we can get to as many as possible in the time that we have. So, Robin, Eva, do you recommend a Mediterranean diet to your patients? Do you incorporate the use of a dietitian or nutritionist in your healthcare team? Eva, let's start with you.
I do not usually incorporate a nutritionist. That's not to say it's not a very wise idea. I think mine has more to do with my setting in a subspecialty rather than primary care. As far as a Mediterranean diet goes, it would just be important to remember from one of our previous slides that although the patients don't have to avoid beef and lamb and pork, they should limit it to a fairly large extent, as much as possible. And then I know sometimes that a variety of cheeses can be an issue too, so it would just be something to be careful about, but I think overall there's a lot of cardiovascular benefit to that particular diet plan, so probably just a few modifications and it would be perfectly acceptable.
Robin, use of dietitians and nutritionists in your practice?
Well, first let me get back to the Mediterranean diet, because okay. that's recommended for our patient with rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah.
It's found to be helpful. And there was a study looking at our patients with cutaneous scleroderma as well. My only problem with the Mediterranean diet is included in that is red wine. And so again, we're trying to limit some of the alcohol intake. So I think certainly for inflammatory arthritis in general, it seems to be helpful. I would like to be able to incorporate a nutritionist or dietitian, not covered by most of my patients' insurance. So I go to the web that we've already said that we can't believe everything that's there, and I'll print out a low urate diet for those patients.
So let me take the next one quickly, which is, what is pseudogout and how is it defined? And by extension, I use the term pseudogout and how it's defined. We've been defining gout as the deposition of uric acid crystals. Pseudogout is the deposition of calcium hydroxyapatite crystals, calcium pyrophosphate, and pseudogout is hydroxyapatite crystals. So the differentiation is made morphologically by looking at the crystals under the polarizing microscope, because clinically all conditions can present identically, and they can present concurrently. So the diagnosis is made by polarizing microscopy and examination of the crystals.
Sometimes on musculoskeletal ultrasound, you can tell the difference between gout and pseudogout, but not always.
And pseudogout, for whoever is taking notes in the audience, usually presents with a shoulder presentation rather than anything else. Are legumes okay?
Well, Choi has written an article talking about looking at animal purines versus plant purines, and although the original low purine diets recommended avoiding asparagus and oatmeal and legumes, his more recent studies have suggested that it's really animal purines that we should be concerned about, not necessarily the plant purines.
So, Eva, here's a question maybe you can help us out with. Is there a link between inflammation, hypertension, sleep apnea, and gout? And is there any data that you're aware of to support this?
I think there is a link. In reviewing the literature, there was commonly a link between the renin-angiotensin system being stimulated and hyperuricemia. And so I think that's why it's not uncommon at all on some of the lists, the comorbidity lists, that hypertension was listed. Again, the challenge comes in, though, as to how to try to narrow down some of the medications that can precipitate the hyperuricemia while still treating the hypertension that's associated with it. I think in that regard, that's another reason to focus on a team approach.
And certainly I think it's that when we're looking at those patients who have sleep apnea, many times they have, as you mentioned, the other comorbid conditions. So, and when we're looking at the risk factors, one thing was sleep apnea. So when if the patient who has gout comes to me and complains of fatigue, that's going to be someone that I'm going to talk to. Well, gosh, we should probably refer you for a sleep study to see if it's not just the inflammation and your other comorbid conditions and the side effects of the medicines causing the fatigue, but maybe you have some sleep apnea as well.
So another colleague said, I am an internal medicine physician and recognize that a number of my patients that present with acute gout are also being cared for by me with hypertension and or hypercholesterolemia. And I think we're beginning to see that whether this is not necessarily causal, it's certainly a complex that we see in many patients. And so these patients probably should be screened for the concomitant illnesses that we're talking about.
No question about that. And that's one thing in the ACR guidelines that they certainly mention, that that's extremely important. And we know, again, not whether it's causal or not, but when you look at soft plaque in coronary blood vessels, their uric acid crystals have actually been found in that soft plaque. So the role that that plays is certainly now being investigated.
So Robin, we talked about this just before we got on camera. A questioner writes, I am a podiatrist and wonder how to best differentiate gout in patients that are referred to me from gait issues or other types of foot pain.
As we talked about, it's important in examining the patient. So if they have a red hot toe, first MTP, their ankle, that's much more likely at least an inflammatory type of arthritis. If it's osteoarthritis, it won't be red, it won't be have any increased warmth. And then most podiatrists have an x-ray in their office. They can get an x-ray. And with gout, they might see a tophus. They might see what we call a rat bite erosion with an overhanging edge with the tophus in the middle. So between the physical exam and the x-ray, that should be helpful. And then throw on in a uric acid level as well.
Yeah, I think it's particularly important for our colleagues who deal with the lower extremity
right.
to be able to understand the presentations of gout. The classical ones, of course, are easily recognized. It's the non-classical ones that may get us into trouble. So here's an interesting question. How, not do, but how do you switch a patient from allopurinol to febuxostat?
Oh, that's something that we didn't discuss, and it's something that I think is really important in that if I have a patient on, let's say, 300 of allopurinol, and their serum uric acid level is still above 6, then when I make that switch, I have to put that patient on anti-inflammatory prophylaxis because the data has shown that when you switch to febuxostat, there can be a very rapid reduction in the serum uric acid level, and just that switch from allopurinol to febuxostat can cause those mobilization flares. The other thing that's important besides starting them on the anti-inflammatory prophylaxis, now you don't have to do it for the full 6 months, but certainly until their serum uric acid level has been down below 6 for a couple months. But then not, it's, if they're on 300 milligrams of allopurinol, it's not recommended immediately to go to 80 of allopurinol, of febuxostat, but actually go to 40 milligrams of febuxostat. And then a couple weeks later, if they need the 80. But the data's shown that about 50% of patients just on 40 milligrams of febuxostat will be able to maintain a serum uric acid level less than 6, and we didn't show that data.
Right.
So just because they're on a maximum dose of, or a commonly held maximum dose of allopurinol doesn't mean they should be switched immediately to the maximum dose of febuxostat.
That's correct.
And if you have a patient that's not responding adequately to allopurinol, is it your practice to try them on febuxostat before you add a second agent to the allopurinol?
That's what the guidelines recommend. They recommend going to allopurinol as long as the patient doesn't have certain risk factors for acute allopurinol hypersensitivity, and then switch over to the febuxostat, and only then, if you can't get it below 6 with the 80 milligrams of febuxostat, then go and add a uricosuric agent, and at present that's the probenecid.
And in fact, we haven't really had a second urate-lowering therapy like lesinurad available to us until fairly recently, if indeed it's available in most parts of the country at all.
And so that would be an option, you know, if the patient, because it has to be used as combination therapy, so that would be a perfect situation instead of using the probenecid to use the lesinurad, and then it all gets down to the basics of taking care of patients and prior authorizations of what the insurance company lets us do.
So, Eva, are there patient teaching sheets that you use for diets and medications for gout that you could recommend that somebody might be able to locate, download, and use in their practice?
I think the best ones would be from the ACR website. Those are probably the, well, not probably, definitely the most dependable and up-to-date and the most widely recognized. So I think there'd be less potential for contradiction if you give them the information from part one of those guidelines.
Yeah, we like to think that the ACR guideline sheets or information are helpful. The ACP has some information.
The Arthritis Foundation at arthritis.org.
I was getting there. Certainly getting there. So here's what I'll refer to as the oh yeah question. We've been talking a lot about the lack of information, and we've been doing some studies on the lack of communication between rheumatologists, primary care physicians, and patients when it comes to gout and kidney disease. Are there any studies on how frequently the nephrologists are discussing gout and kidney disease with their patients? That's why I call it the oh yeah question.
I'm not aware of that data.
Are you?
No, I'm not.
No, neither am I. It's a great question. It would be interesting if we surveyed nephrologists to see if their interactions with patients with kidney disease are going to be very different from ours. Great project. I'll put a fellow on it as soon as I get back to the office. Now, here's a topic that could lend itself to several hours, but we've only got several minutes for it. And it begins like this. The benefit-harm discussion is a very hot and litigious topic in our area. From our area, I'm guessing it's one of the 50 United States. Do you have a recommendation on how to document or when or cover this area with patients? Eva, I'll start with you.
Well, I think as long as you're documenting at regular intervals, or if not every visit, that you've gone over the same lifestyle recommendations, the same importance of reaching the target hyperuricemia, of carefully managing their medications by the guidelines. I think all of those things together combined should be enough to protect you from any potential litigious onset.
So for me, this is very funny because we were talking this before we got on camera, is that that having chronic hyperuricemia and gout is associated with, as we talked about, chronic kidney disease, joint damage, et cetera, but the medicines also have side effects too. And especially, as you mentioned, Eva, the interactions of especially colchicine with different antibiotics, TB drugs, with statins, and many of these patients are on statins. So talking to the patients about the side effects of the medicine, but talking to them about that, that if they don't take the medicine, they can end up with chronic gouty arthritis, they can have worsening of their chronic kidney disease, and that's the side effect of not treating. And then the side effect of treating means that they have to come back and get blood tests done to look for toxicity of the medicine. And I'm a very controlling person, and they have to let me know if another doctor started them on a new medication, so I can be the responsible one to make certain that there's not a drug interaction there.
So I'll give the didactic response. Maybe one of our listeners saw two initials after my name that tipped them off to the question. We're talking about informed consent. And informed consent is a process. It's not a piece of paper. Informed consent is a process whereby you disclose risks, benefits, and alternatives to a patient, as well as the risks and benefits of those alternatives. So you can give informed consent to a patient. You don't get informed consent, you give it, because that's the process. And then the second part is, how do you document what you've done? Well, there are many ways of documenting it. You can have a form that's signed, and we're all used to that from our medical training, where you go in and get the form signed. But that's not really informed consent as much as it is documentation. You can put an entry into your medical record, which is becoming more and more easy to do with electronic medical records. But even in the absence of an electronic medical record, you can dictate a note in your chart, which is something simple as risks, benefits, and alternatives of urate-lowering therapy discussed with Mrs. Smith, or risks, benefits, and alternatives of allopurinol discussed with Mrs. Smith. Risks include, but are not limited to, and you list a few, and then the patient understands and agrees. If you're dealing with certain classes of patients, you might even want to have them sign that note, or document from one of your office staff that note was dictated contemporaneously and witnessed by the patient or made aware to the patient. So these are strategies for both giving the information and documenting that the information was given. And depending upon the patient, the circumstances of what you do may actually vary.
And the new ACP guidelines, actually in every section, they're talking about risk-benefit. So the ACP is certainly very interested to make certain that those who read those guidelines do participate in that risk-benefit discussion.
Exactly right. If the guidelines that were just published from the ACP differ at all from the ACR, it's the stronger emphasis on documentation of risks, benefits, and alternatives. So here's something that would brighten our day. I am a nurse practitioner, and your program was outstanding and talked about so many issues I see in real practice where patients are not engaged in their care. If it was outstanding, Eva, it was due to your participation in it. Can you comment on how clinicians and the care team should talk to patients and engage them in their care? And I think they want some more specifics here.
Well, and I think as a nurse practitioner, that's where we can fill the need with a shortage of extremely busy specialists and a shortage of primary care providers, physicians specifically. We can be the ones in that clinic role to go in and make the time, whether it's 20 minutes, 30 minutes, or 45, to make sure that the patient fully understands their new diagnosis or their worsening gout. and fully understands the importance of reaching those serum target levels of 6 or even 5. So I think, you know, with the specifics of the reinforcing the guidelines from the different societies and constantly reviewing with them their dietary restrictions and taking the time, I think that can be definitely a way for people to get better control of this problem.
What Kaiser Permanente does in Southern California, they actually have group patient visits. So they'll schedule people who have gout to come in. There'll be 6 or 8 of them. They'll then have a discussion with usually a nurse practitioner. And then after that, they go and see their providers to go over their specific case. So it's a way of associating education with the provider visit. In other rheumatology offices that I know of, usually the rheumatologist sees the patient, and they say that then the nurse practitioner or physician assistant will come in, answer any questions that they have, explain diet and side effects of the medicine. So as you said, often the physician is busy going from patient to patient, but that's again where the nurse practitioner or physician assistant can really play a very important role in patient education.
So I'm hearing a lot from our colleagues about how they're using these group sessions for patients with a variety of chronic diseases,
right,
because they achieve education as well as peer reinforcement.
Yeah, so a great model of that is the age-old diabetic nurse educator. Mm-hmm. But there's no reason why we can't expand that role and emphasize it into a variety of different specialties, including rheumatology, because not just with gout, but you know, other conditions that are chronic and inflammatory. Things like diet and lifestyle are key to management.
That's right.
So Eva, I'm going to let you handle this one. It's both a question and a statement. And the question is, and statement is, I am seeing too many patients with gout referred to orthopedics for surgery. Can you comment on the importance of surgery being a last resort in these patients?
Well, absolutely. The group of orthopedic surgeons I work with, I think, does an exceptional job at trying to be very careful about the patients and how they're screened for surgery, trying to make sure that all of their conservative treatment is maximized, and understanding that, you know, a patient who has had gout for quite a while and is referred for maybe joint replacement or arthroscopy, again, needs to understand that one procedure on one joint is not going to change, in the grand scheme of things, the fact that they have gout and that it's a chronic lifelong condition to be managed.
And I actually had a case of that I got a referral from the orthopedist with this man who had a very long Samoan name. And mm-hmm. as we know, Pacific Islanders genetically cannot handle elevated levels of uric acid in the diet. So they called me up, said his MRI did not show any mechanical problem that would have been responsible for the severity of his knee pain. And I said, oh, I was certain just because of his Samoan descent that he might have gout. His serum uric acid level was normal on the reference mm-hmm. lab, but that's something I didn't mention. Mm-hmm. And the normal for the reference lab can be between 4 and 8.5,
yeah.
But it's not our goal of therapy. And so they said their uric acid was, quote, normal. And so they sent him to me. He had diabetes, chronic kidney disease, hypertension, obesity, all the risk factors we talked about. I stuck a needle in his joint that the orthopedist hadn't done, and there were just loads of gout crystals. So at least he got to me before having surgery, but it was only because his symptoms were so severe and his MRI was normal.
Yeah.
So I think we agree that surgery of a patient with gout should be the last resort, because there are other things we should try to dissolve that tophus as well, keeping in mind that this is a multiple joint disease, even when we only see the tophus in one area.
So certainly I think if you have a patient with a potato-sized tophus and you got them on pegloticase, the IV, every couple weeks, and you haven't been able to shrink that tophus, I've had patients who've had a potato-sized tophus that has been surgically removed just because it keeps getting infected because they're leaning on their elbows.
Yeah.
But for a meniscus or pain in a joint, certainly that is definitely a last resort.
So you may have answered the next question, Robin, which comes from someone who says, when using pegloticase, and the patient has an infusion reaction in the context of the refractory gout, what do you try next?
Oh, that's really a good question. certainly I would not give them the Piccolo case anymore. And that's a patient that we definitely use the combination therapy like we talked about before. So probably assuming this patient was not on a lesinurad clinical trial. So I would definitely, in that patient, I would use not only febuxostat in combination with lesinuride, but then look at the concomitant medications that the patient was on. So that the recommendation is if they are on niacin to use something else to control their hypertriglyceridemia. If they're like gemfibrozil, looking at their hypertension, we know that losartan is uricosuric. So to try to put them on a drug that causes uricosuria. I might have that patient, depending on what their other comorbid conditions are, on low doses of steroids, maybe 5 milligrams a day. That might be, you know, a patient if they're really overweight and can't get their weight under control, I might refer them for bariatric surgery just to try to decrease their overall, you know, burden of inflammation associated with the obesity. But there was an article in the Journal of American Medical Association about 5 years ago that talked exactly about that type of patient and talked about we have to look at the other medicines they're taking for their comorbid conditions and try to maximize those.
So here's a question that came in. I wonder if our good friend Oren Traum is listening. Does MRI have a role in the diagnosis of gout? Robin?
Certainly, and I understand why you said that, imaging techniques can certainly be important. There's something called a DECT scan that is a CT methodology that shows the crystals very well. In Europe, they're very rarely now performing joint aspirations unless they're worried about a septic joint because there's a double contour sign that's very characteristic on a musculoskeletal ultrasound for gout. I will tell you, though, that I recently had a patient that the insurance would not approve a musculoskeletal ultrasound, and they demanded that I order an MRI instead. So my feeling would be only to order the MRI if a musculoskeletal ultrasound wasn't approved or available in that situation.
Amazing. Ava, your experience with musculoskeletal ultrasound and MRI?
My experience would be that it's probably more of an exclusionary tool to make sure that there's not something else going on in the joint, like a torn meniscus, that you know, or advanced chondromalacia that could be the source of their ongoing pain. But it's not really used commonly that I've seen.
Okay, Robin, we didn't discuss this class of agents, but someone's asking about evidence for the use of anakinra for the treatment of acute gout. And maybe by extension, you can say something about other IL-1 inhibitors.
That would certainly be an off-label indication, but I should have mentioned... I certainly should have mentioned that in that patient who had that refractory gout, that going to anakinra would be a possibility, although off-label. As you know, that's a 100 milligram daily injection. These patients can have very large injection site reactions. It's available only from one pharmacy now, but that certainly is an option. We know that there was another IL-1 inhibitor that attempted to come to market a couple years ago and was not approved because of the increased incidence in infections in those patients who were treated. My problem is, when I talk to people, they talk to me about being the practical practicing rheumatologist. If you have somebody who has an acute gout flare, how soon are we going to be able to get their IL-1 inhibitor approved by their insurance? It's probably not going to happen. Yeah. And so that they would have to have a supply of this at home if they're using it to treat their acute attack, because we know that one of the inflammatory messengers that those inflammatory cells give is IL-1. So if we can prevent that IL-1 from being released from the white blood cells, then we can prevent that acute gout from happening. But my experience has been that many of these gout patients, they don't even want to take their pills, you know, faithfully. And so having them do a daily injection or 3 times a week injection, I think, is not a very practical thing. But academically, it certainly is something of great interest in rheumatology.
So, Robin, since you're the practical rheumatologist at the table, a questioner asks, isn't colchicine cost prohibitive or not reimbursed?
Well, not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore.
Luckily, there are many generics that are now available. But I will tell you that for some of my patients, their insurance covers the brand name, but not one of the generics. So there are several different generics that are available, and that was certainly the case when there was only the brand name. But now there are many of the generics that are no longer cost prohibitive.
Yeah, I think our questioner is referring to the situation we had a number of years ago when only one manufacturer had the ability to market approved colchicine, right, even though it had been generic for several hundred years. And then as a result of that, the price went up. But now with other generics, the price is back down. So no, it's no longer a cost prohibitive. And I'm unaware of any companies that are not reimbursing colchicine at this time because
certainly
of
if
that.
The patient didn't have insurance, that might be the case. But remember, part of the problem with colchicine being expensive and only from one manufacturer was because the FDA said, we're going to take drugs off the market that are old but yet have been used for a long time unless there's a clinical trial that looks at risk,
right,
associated with these. So Belergal, an old medicine that I use for hot flashes, was taken off the market because no company wanted to do that study in order to determine that it was safe and effective for continued use.
So, Robin, you showed us the very nice curve of risk of flare as a function of uric acid
mm-hmm.
serum level. But this questioner writes, I have a patient with low uric acid levels, about 2, and normal renal function, yet they still have flare-ups. What should I do? What's the next step?
I have one patient like that, and it's certainly not easy. And so, and in that patient, that's going to be someone that I'm going to be using that chronic anti-inflammatory prophylaxis. So in those patients, I'm using 0.6 milligrams of colchicine every day. I will probably, as long as they're not have low blood pressure, I'll add Losartan to that patient, and I'll talk to them about diet, look at their other medicines. But that can happen, and I guess maybe if we had a 24-hour serum uric acid monitor that we'd be able to see that at times it was elevated, but that certainly can happen, and then it's a matter of really trying to keep that low, but looking at those other things that Eva was talking about, the lifestyle, making sure they're not getting dehydrated, looking at their concomitant medications.
So this next question, and depending upon how we answer it, maybe a teaser for a future CME program. Do you worry about the cardiac effect of using non-steroidals? Eva, let me start with you.
Well, yeah, that's always something I try to review carefully in my patients' charts, because being in orthopedics, that's what I prescribe, 9 out of 10 times in a day. And so my biggest precluders for that are a significant cardiovascular history, mainly if they've had an event like a bypass surgery, if they've had stents placed, if they've had a history of a diagnosed MI. But as long as that's not the case, and as long as they've never had any history of GI bleeds or ulcers, I generally feel very comfortable prescribing them. There's always risk. And you always have the patient that reads the insert from, cover to cover, that's going to be scared to use it. But for now, it's very inexpensive, it's very effective, and as long as they don't meet the worst of those criteria, I generally feel pretty comfortable giving it.
Robin?
And I think that's the difference of an acute situation like in orthopedics and a chronic situation in rheumatology. And I'm pretty sure the data shows that over the last several years that rheumatologists have been prescribing fewer and fewer NSAIDs for chronic use, and the FDA tells us that we should use the lowest dose for the shortest period of time. So again, for an orthopedics, I see that. Certainly in these patients who have gout, who usually have these other comorbidities, as you mentioned, that's going to be the patient that I'm probably going to use colchicine or a steroid. And especially now, so many of these patients are taking the new antiplatelet agents, and we're not supposed
right.
to use NSAIDs within those patients. I'm using fewer and fewer NSAIDs.
So I think we're actually going to see some data come out of the long-term study on non-steroidals being conducted at the Cleveland Clinic later this month at the American College of Rheumatology meeting. The topic of cardiovascular risk with use of non-steroidals has been a hotly debated one over the last decade or so. And so I think it's always something to keep in mind when using non-steroidals acutely or chronically in patients with multiple comorbidities.
And having said that, I guess I should clarify that when I prescribe NSAIDs, I generally don't like to do them for more than a month before I make a decision to then try another type of treatment, whether it's a corticosteroid injection or, switching them to, maybe a Medrol dose pack or a longer-term low-dose steroid. It's not something that I would keep them on for several months. If they required that, then I will usually sort of get them back to their PCP with the knowledge that their renal function is going to have to be measured on a regular basis, and they generally are going to need to be monitored for any potential cardiovascular problems.
So I'm going to make this the last question because I think it really wraps everything up and gives us the opportunity to comment on it. Should I be screening patients with gout for kidney disease, and should I be screening patients with kidney disease for gout? Which comes first, the chicken or the egg, Robin?
If you look at the EULAR guidelines, which we talked about before, where we like the ACR guidelines better, the EULAR guidelines actually talk about in any patient who has CKD or hypertension to automatically measure their serum uric acid level. And they're recommending the EULAR guidelines, if the patient has CKD 2 or worse, that you check their uric acid level and it's elevated, you actually start them on urate lowering therapy. Now that is not an approved indication for these drugs here in this country, but in a small study that was done with febuxostat and larger studies done in Europe with all of the different other drugs that they have here that we don't have here, it was shown that by controlling the patient's hyperuricemia, that their blood pressure and their kidney disease actually improved.
So I'm going to wrap it up in the interest of time. I want to tell you that we had over 60 questions, and we tried to get to as many as we could in the time that we have. We've got many, many more. 81 of these questions that the audience submitted could be the beginning of a new symposium. But I do want to thank our faculty, Dr. Doerr, Dr. Hardy, again for joining me today. I also want to thank you, our audience, for your participation, as well as our patient leaders who provided us with specific feedback that helped shape our program today and ensured that we included all the key issues important to our patients. Thank you to CME Outfitters for your assistance in developing this education activity. And again, thank you to the audience. You took time out of your very busy day to learn ways to improve the care of your patients with gout. And frankly, I hope that you got something out of it. I'm Dr. Alan Gabowski. I hope that you're able to incorporate some of these recommendations we provided for you into the optimal care of your patients. And speaking on behalf of Ms. Hardy, Dr. Doerr, and myself, we look forward to working with you again and answering your questions in future programs. Thank you.